So first of all, Jonathan, thank you again for hosting, and thank you for going the extra mile to make sure we would have lunch today. Despite great challenges, you came through for us. Much appreciated.
Otherwise, it would just be a done without the lunch.
And that's not, no, can't do that. Can't do that. So the topic for this month is the topic of reading leaked and misdirected emails. And there is indeed a lot to talk about with this. It actually started for me with a question I was asked. A fellow asked me a great case. He has a certain business, and since a lot of this is going to be about privacy, I have to make sure not to divulge. But he's not here in the room. But he has a business, and like many businessmen, he also is on the email list of his competitors. He wants to see what they're putting out and what they're sending out. So they sent one of their emails not long ago to their list, and they made a mistake and did not BCC the customer list. So in other words, he received not only their email, but he received a list of all of their customers as part of it. And so his question is he allowed, from a Jewish ethical perspective, is he allowed to market to that list? Can he pick out names and say, I think you might be in the market for what I do, and I'd like to show you why my product is good and so forth. Can he take advantage of their mistake? What would you say? We have a no, and we have a don't ask me. Okay.
I would say it's no, because it wasn't intended by error if he got that.
Okay.
You don't know that.
Well, we do know it was an error. In other words, they don't normally send that. Yeah, they sent a recall afterwards. It was clear that it was an error. Yes. And it wasn't their method. Normally, they do BCC. Someone made a mistake, as, we've all done and had done to us from time to time.
Does it depend if they're Jewish or not?
Does it depend on whether they're Jewish or not? Excellent question. As it happens, what we're going to talk about, some of the issues relate to Jews and non-Jews. Some of them are Jewish-specific, so we'll have to draw that distinction. The short answer was no, he's not allowed to use it. And not only not allowed to use it from a Jewish ethics perspective, but also from a federal law perspective. I pronounce it this way, and others pronounce it a different way, the PIPEDA Act, or whatever they call it, PIPEDA.
It's
That actually doesn't take the place of this, but it adds certain features. Right, PIPEDA, thank you. So PIPEDA prevents commercial use of email addresses, however they are obtained, without permission of the addressee. So in other words, if I am the customer, and now somebody contacts me out of the blue, and I didn't want him to contact me, he's actually in violation of the PIPEDA Act. It is also in CASEL, the Canada Anti-Spam legislation, but that's broader in application. For example, CASEL will include nonprofits that are sending commercial messages. It also, CASEL imposes a requirement that when you send an email, you have to include an unsubscription option. Like, CASEL is broader in scope and has a deeper effect. But that was the question that got me thinking about presenting this topic of leaked and misdirected emails. So you can see on the sheet, I gave you three cases. Right, case number one. My coworker forwarded to me an email about a project. He didn't cut off a further exchange from the bottom. A quick look shows me that the lower part is personal and not part of what he intended me to see. May I read it? This is not necessarily a business question. This is just a general ethical question. Am I allowed to read what he unwittingly included at the bottom? What would you say?
How do you know for sure that it was unwitting?
You don't. You have to make your best guess.
You usually can't guess it once you read it.
Right. No, I mean, you have enough of a sense that this is something that was really a private communication, not part of the... that we can all invent cases in which that may be the case. Well, that's question number one. Question number two happens to me all the time. Well, not the nasty part, but the general part. Because my last name is Torchiner, I frequently receive emails for other Torchiners, because my address is torchiner@gmail.com. So people will think they're sending to some other Torchiner and they'll send to me, which, generally, thank God so far, the emails have been benign and there are no terrible ramifications to it. But the question is, a cousin meant to send my brother a nasty email about me, but she has trouble keeping track of email addresses, and she sent it to me instead. May I read it? In other words, I read the opening lines, I see where this is going, I see it says, dear somebody, and that somebody ain't me. Is there anything wrong with me reading the email?
Yes.
Yes, why?
It wasn't intended for you.
And here you know it wasn't intended for you, as opposed to the previous case.
Absolutely.
Where the email was sent to you, is just, you don't know what they intended to include. Okay, then we go third. Third case.
Give me a simple answer to all
that. Yeah.
It's a desired derogation. That covers it all. We can't read anybody else's mail without their permission.
Right.
And without an email, mail, whatever it is, to me, I would imagine.
But they've sent it to you.
That one thing alone covers every aspect of anything you want to discuss.
So Jerry says, let's go to dessert. We have this 1,000-year-old decree of Rabbeinu Gershom, or we think it's Rabbeinu Gershom, we're going to come back to that, in which this great leader of German Jewry and really European Jewry of his day made a series of decrees, and one of them was, you're not allowed to read somebody else's mail. But I would ask Jerry, whether that decree necessarily applies, first of all, to email. Is this about letters, or is this about email? Does this apply if he is careless? As opposed to where he sent a letter to somebody else and I'm going to hijack it, he sent it to me.
Right? Okay, well, I'm thinking I haven't read his word.
No one has. I'll tell you why later.
But the word, the spirit of what he did, and I don't say that it's 1,000 years old and therefore because every 1,000 years goes away, because otherwise I'm going to have to get married to some old woman as well. Because he's the guy who said you can't marry more than one wife, right?
The issue of a decree expiring after 1,000 years requires its own class, and we can do that at some point.
What I'm saying is, you've got to follow the spirit of it. Like anything else in your life, you have something that's very oblique, or you have something that's specific to one thing, maybe a farming law, and we take that and we apply it to business law and all kinds of stuff, because that's what our company is. Like a gross, it's based on a principle which you can interpret and bring up. So to me, it would seem that if he says you can't read a letter, his idea behind it was that he doesn't want people to know people's private business because that's like dealing with theft. That's theft of their information. And I would imagine that this thing is the same thing.
So it's going to get more complicated than that. It will get more complicated than that. You'll see.
Isn't there a presumption that the person, once they realize they see they sent it to you, it means that you've already read it? Because it's like they're sending an open letter. It's like if you want to compare it to an old mail, this isn't a sealed envelope. This envelope is open.
Yes.
Basically, it's open before you. And when that person who sent it, even though you were not the intended recipient, will see at the end, you know, that will realize in it that you actually have received it. Mm-hmm. Isn't there an assumption that that person will think that you've already read it? Meaning, so is there an issue? Is that a sign to say that you can actually?
Because they gave up. They gave up already.
Yeah.
An interesting possibility. We'll have to talk about that as well. One more question, though, and this one is highly prevalent in the world of WikiLeaks and the Sony leaks and various hacks. The third question: my competitor was hacked, and his customer database was released online. May I use the customer contact information to recruit new customers for myself? Or not just that, but let's say people's emails are leaked and they appear all over the place, right? I can read Hillary Clinton's yoga emails online. I can read whatever, you know, that's been, you know, poured out of people's computers. Is there some point in which this enters the public domain and now it's fine for me to read it, even though the original intent was for it to be private? So I want to deal with all of these in the next 40 minutes or so. So let's see what we can do. There are, first of all, the basic principle. Reading somebody else's email is indeed prohibited under Jewish law for at least 5 different reasons. But it's important to see the reasons because they model communication differently. Each one has a different legal theory. The first theory is your mail is an extension of your person. And to read someone else's mail is an invasion of that person's privacy. There is a basic value of privacy within Jewish ethics and within Jewish law, and it is to be honored. So if you take a look at the first source, I brought you a comment of the Midrash which points out The Torah states, "Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe b'midbar Sinai." God spoke to Moshe, Moses, in the Sinai wilderness. So it picks up on the way the Torah frames God's conversations with Moshe based on venue, and how it starts out with God speaking to Moshe at this burning bush out in the open, and then in Egypt, and then in Midian, and then in Sinai. But once they establish what's called the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting, at that point, that's the only place God speaks to him, is inside this tent. And the fact that the Torah specifies it is what the Medrash picks up on, and it says, God chooses to speak to Moshe inside a tent because privacy is good. Meaning that, even though everything God is going to say to Moshe is supposed to be broadcast to the nation, right? Everything God is going to tell him, he's going to turn around and tell everybody else. Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe l'emor. God told Moshe, go tell everybody else. Nonetheless, it is appropriate to value privacy. And this comes up in various areas of Jewish law. For example, if you remember the blessing that the prophet Bilam gave to the Jews, Matovu Ohalecha Yaakov, he says, your tents are wonderful, Jacob. Says the Medrash on that. What is he praising about our tents? Anybody know?
Couldn't see from one to the other.
They had zoning laws. The zoning laws said that your entrance can't open into opposite somebody else's entrance, that people shouldn't be able to see from one person's tent into the other. We have a law called Hezek Re'iyah, which says that I am not allowed to look into somebody else's property. Even if it's available, I'm driving down the street, their shades are open, I'm not allowed to look into their house. And if you take a look at source number 2, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi was the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he wrote his own Shulchan Aruch, his own code of Jewish law. And he says there in number 2, I bring the Hebrew always, so you'll have it for Hebrew readers, but I'm going to read that from the English in the interest of time. He says, one may not stand by another's field to gaze into it when the grain is standing, lest he harm it with a bad eye. And the idea of harming it with a bad eye is an issue of jealousy. You see how much he has, you say, well, why is his doing well? Mine is not doing well. And you're upset about that, and you turn to God and say, well, why does he get? And there's a concern for the effect of the jealousy. But then he continues and says, even where jealousy is irrelevant, even for another person's business and deeds where harm from one's eye is not relevant, one may not look without permission if he is in his home or property. Why? Perhaps he does not want people to know his deeds and business. The person who is the owner of the home, the person who is the owner of the business, doesn't necessarily want you looking. And therefore, we honor a person's privacy. It's an extension of himself. And reading somebody's mail would then be an invasion of privacy. That's a basic value, and that's one model. But we go beyond that. You could also model mail as property. Not part of my person, but as property of mine. And if you take my property and forward it to somebody else, or read it when I didn't want you to read it, then what you've done is essentially an act of stealing. It's theft. To take my email, which I sent to somebody, even though it's intangible. It is the most intellectual of intellectual property. Nonetheless, you can't use my property in a way that I don't agree with. So if you take a look at source number 3, Rabbi Chaim Shabtai, in 16th century Greece, wrote in the work Tarat Chaim regarding reading somebody else's mail. You can tell, by the way, as you see the centuries that I quote here, that this has been an issue for a very long time. This issue of reading other people's mail is not new. So he writes, if you read somebody else's mail, he is using the other's property without his knowledge. This is like borrowing without consent. He is a thief. That's what we call it when you borrow without asking. So that's the second way to frame it, is that it's actually theft. By the way, I'm going to pass around a sign-in sheet. This is for people to put their email address down so that you can get follow-up from this class. I always like to send out a link to the audio, people to download, and so forth. So if you would like to get that, and I don't have your email address, make sure you write it in. If I already have your email address, then you don't need to put your address in. And then the last column is if you want to get weekly email advertising our programs. It's a free weekly email. If you don't want to get it, you don't have to enter anything there. We will be sure in a class on, using people's addresses and so forth, we will not send you the weekly email if you don't want it. Have no fear. So I'm passing that around. Okay. So the first two models are male is an extension of your person, and the second is that male is an extension of your property. The third one is, to me, the most fascinating model. The third model is that your male, your email in this case, is your communication. You have the right to choose with whom you communicate. If somebody takes your email and forwards it to somebody else, they have forced you to communicate with somebody you didn't want to. And that in and of itself is a problem. This is a whole other way that you can look at the subject. Take a look, please, at... I'm actually going to change the order of the sources that I have on the sheet. Take a look at source number 6, which may be the most powerful expression of this. Source number 6 is a passage from the Talmud which points out how every time God speaks to Moshe and he wants Moshe to tell the Jews, he always says, go tell them, lemor. And so the text here says, the Talmud comments, how do we know that one may not repeat that which he is told until he is told, go tell? Because the verse says, and God told Moshe in the tent of meeting to tell the Jews. In other words, if someone tells me something, I have to have the presumption of confidentiality. The default is, don't tell it to somebody else. In the event that, you know, this happens all the time, well, they didn't say to be quiet. They didn't say to be quiet about it. They didn't say not to tell. It doesn't matter. The default is, you can't repeat it. That is absolutely 100% halal.
So you don't need to specifically say don't say anything. If he doesn't say that, you can't.
That is correct.
So what about the modern practices for reading emails?
So I believe that it's wrong. I believe that it's wrong. I don't believe you're allowed to forward someone else's email without permission. There are exceptions to the rule. Where there is a standard practice of conveying certain information, and it's even to their benefit, then if they don't say, you can do it. So, for example, in a not happy situation, someone passes away, and the shul sends out an email letting people know, or just you know, and you want people to be able to come to the funeral. So you're allowed to go tell people that somebody passed away for a happy occasion. Also, if it's the type of thing that people broadcast, it's fine for you to broadcast that. But unless there's a popular convention, you know, it's very hard to justify it in the eyes of Jewish law. Yes.
I can see where this could spill over into Lashon Hara.
And we're getting there too. You are right.
Oh, wait.
Okay. I mean, you could either way. But we are getting to that. Yes, Jeff.
Tell me when it's appropriate to ask this question, which is an employee on a company server who should be talking to business.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, people who are entitled to access that level of information should have access, or the writer should know there may be access.
Right.
And the other scenario is someone in the public service, happens to be in the news these days again, from your office, people deleting emails. Don't they all work for us? What is it that they're writing that we in the public should or should not know? Who decides who can share that, who can destroy it?
Correct. I mean, from a secular perspective, the rule is that an employer is allowed to scan the emails, but only if there's transparency. If the worker knows that the employer is going to look. If the worker is not informed, it's against the law. From a Jewish ethics perspective, I think the same rule would pertain. If you're going to tell him, what you're writing is a postcard. Right? It's open in any, you know, not anybody, but within our office, we're allowed to see it. Then he has no complaint, because he was informed in advance and there's no presumption of privacy. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. So let me come back to it. But this is our third model. You can't force someone to communicate with people who he doesn't want to communicate. If you take a look at source number 7, this is brought as law by Rabbi Yosef Chagiz in Morocco in the 17th century, who says, regarding divulging a person's secrets to oneself, not taking his secrets and conveying them to a third party, but I am reading his secret information, which I wasn't meant to. He says, it appears that one may not seek out another's secrets. What will be the difference between gossip about others and about oneself? Meaning, if I take his information and I spread it to a third party, that is me gossiping about him to somebody else. If I take his information and read it myself, so I'm making him gossip to me, so to speak. Again, I'm extending the communication from him to me in a way that he never had intended. So that's a third model for why Jewish law will say not to do it.
Supposing there's something constructive in this law. Let us say, after having read it, you know that there's some conspiracy going on. Mm. And you have to take some action in order to prevent it from happening. So, which means, it's true, you're not allowed to benefit from this extended privacy, but if you see there's a plot there,
right,
or something malicious.
Right. So what I wanted to do, actually, when I was thinking, you know, in the last few days, when it was too late to add this to the class at this point, but as things came out with Apple and the iPhone from the San Bernardino shootings, what I think I would like to do, and I'll ask people for feedback afterwards, is for our next class to actually deal with the wrongdoing cases. And the question of that would be one: can the government force somebody, force them to unlock the phone? But also questions about spouses. Spouse thinks that something is going on between their spouse and somebody else. Are they allowed to eavesdrop? Are they allowed to read emails? Because they're protecting themselves at this point. They think something is wrong. Businesses: you think the partner is doing something wrong, or spying on the babysitter. All these sorts of things. People have, the nanny cam type of a setup. Are those allowed? So I think that's all going to have to be a part two. It's not going to be able to fit into this lunch. We would need more dessert for that one, and we'd anger the Minha people. But that's the third. The fourth issue is that this is a tort. It's a tort, meaning from a law perspective, it's an act of assault on somebody, because you're doing something that you know that they don't want to them. So for example, and this goes back to what Faye had said about Lashon Hara, they go back to source number 5. Number 4, I'm skipping, it just reiterated what number 3 said. It was the same idea that it's like theft. But he also points out the tort issue. But Rambam, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, writes, statements which, if publicized, would cause financial harm, physical harm, or even pain or fear, are lashon hara. Right? Lashon hara, harmful speech. One may not live in such people's neighborhoods. If you know people who speak lashon hara, he says you can't live in their neighborhood, let alone sit with them and listen to them. This is going to change. This is going to change real estate values. This is something you could look into. Like, this could be a RioCan project. Lashon hara free.
We have a no bully zone.
You have a no bully zone?
Yeah, in our malls.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. But this could be a
walk-in.
The only housing development I know of, though, that has a sort of lashon hara free zone is the cemetery. But maybe this is something we could work on. Well, that's also true, unfortunately. But that's not from the residents. There's limits to what you can do when you have guests. But that's the fourth issue, and then the fifth and last is a basic public policy issue. And this goes back to what Jerry pointed out, and that was the decree of Rabbeinu Gershom. So Rabbeinu Gershom was indeed the leader of European Jewry, and certainly Ashkenazi Jewry it views him as one of its key ancestors, going back to the 10th century. But here we have a problem. There is a decree that is credited to Rabbeinu Gershom against reading people's mail, but we don't have the original. What we have are people from 13th century, 14th century, who quoted as being from him, and others just mention the decree but don't actually say that it's from him at all. So we don't actually know for certain. How did we get this idea that it's from him? So first, take a look at number 8. Number 8 comes from Rabbi Chiel Michalevsky. It is Aruch HaShulchan, who is dealing with the issue also of reading people's mail. And he says, I will also cite from Be'er HaGolah, a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law, who says, not to read another's letter without his permission unless he throws it out. That's the rule that Be'er HaGolah states, quoting Rabbeinu Gershom. So that's a text. A text of the decree is, at least according to this version, don't read someone else's letter without his permission unless he throws it out. If he throws it out, and when we say throws it out, we mean in a place where it's accessible to people, then apparently he's fine with it. But take a look at number 9. Number 9, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, if you remember the terrorist attack on Sukkot, they killed Eitam Henkin, that was his son. So Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin notes this problem of did Rabbeinu Gershom write it or not, and he offers some suggestion for how we can know that he did it. He says, it is not found explicitly in early writers that Rabbeinu Gershom enacted the ban. Maharam Bar Baruch, who I believe is 13th century Germany, maybe 14th, wrote without attribution, a ban not to read the writing of another, which he sends to another, without his knowledge. It is prohibited. But if he throws it out, one may. That's his version of the ban. Now, in context, first, he, meaning Maharam Bar Baruch, brought bans and enactments in the name of early authorities in Gaonim, and the name of the sages of Germany and France. So it could have been from any of those. It didn't have to be Rabbeinu Gershom per se. But see responsa of Rashi, 70, quoted in the Mordechai, who said that Rabbeinu Gershom decreed a separate decree, not to mention the sins of a penitent in front of him. In other words, if you have a person who has sinned and then repented from it, you're not supposed to say it in front of him. You're not supposed to talk about it. He's not talking about just any sin here. You have to know your history. You're talking about the period between the 11th and between the 10th and 13th century in Europe. What are we talking about when we talk about a penitent here?
What Crusades talking about?
Correct. Pre-Crusades and Crusades. You're talking about somebody who was forced by the church to pass as a Christian on penalty of death if he didn't. And you have somebody who did that, who said, well, I'm saving my life. And then repented and said, you know, I want to drop that. I'm going to announce that I am a Jew, in fact. And at great peril, they often did. And there was a big fight within the communities about accepting them back. Because the people who had never gone that route said, we toughed it out all along. You passed as a Christian. You think you're just going to come back? There were issues of whether you can marry their kids. There were issues of whether they'd be allowed to testify in a court of law. Would they count for a minion? Like, it was a very big fight, and it was multi-generational, with different tactics taken, interestingly, in the Ashkenazi and Sephardi communities. The Sephardi communities tend to be much more welcoming for them to come back, tracing back probably to the Rambam and his policy on these issues, to Maimonides. The Ashkenazi communities had a much harder time with it, and there were public fights over the issue. So Rabbeinu Gershom makes a decree saying, if a person returns, you're not allowed to make him feel bad. You're not allowed to say to him, remember what you did. You know, back then. By the way, Jerry, the list has stopped. You can just that's good, right? So that's one decree of Rabbeinu Gershom, and then in Maharam Bar Baruch, this ban is also brought without attribution: a ban not to embarrass those who have repented of their sin before them, a ban not to see the writing of another, etc. It sounds somewhat that if the first came from Rabbeinu Gershom, then the second did as well. To clarify and unpack that a little bit, what he's saying is we know that the issue of not saying to somebody, "I know what you did," we know that that's Rabbeinu Gershom. We know that Maharam Bar Baruch quotes that decree along with the reading the mail decree. So therefore, we assume they both came from the same author. But we don't actually know 100% that Rabbeinu Gershom is the author of this. In any case, what this comes down to is a separate policy statement of don't read somebody else's mail. Now, given that I already gave you four other reasons not to read somebody's mail, right? It's, you know, it's part of their person and their entitled to privacy. It's their communication. You're not allowed to make them communicate with somebody they didn't wish to. It's a tort. It's all of these different explanations. Why do we need Rabbeinu Gershom at all? The answer is it's probably just to express a practical application of the principles we've already listed because the community needs it. There's a need within the community because, unfortunately, even though we have certain values, there will be people who will say, I never heard the rabbi say this wasn't allowed. So therefore, Rabbeinu Gershom says, okay, now I'm telling you, this isn't allowed. And it gives it great force because it's coming from a figure who is the leader of Ashkenazi Jewry, really, in his day. So the question is, when you look at his text, not to read another's letter without permission, does that include email? So Jerry says, well, of course it includes email. And that's the position of Rabbi Yaakov Avram Cohen in source number 10, who said, yeah, this violates the well-known ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. He says, even though it's electronic, it's absolutely included.
How does he justify it? Because it's not a closed letter like we usually...
Correct. his view is
basically, could you equate it to somebody who's basically thrown it away or thrown it out?
So he argues no. He views it as about the intent. And fundamentally, the person wrote it thinking it was private. Granted, it's not in an envelope, so to speak. It's not encrypted with, you know, a password on the user end or something like that. Nonetheless, he says it's clear that the person did not intend it for the world, or he would have sent it to the world. That's his take.
Something there.
Yeah.
Most emails that I've ever seen, there's a clause at the bottom. This email is for the recipient of the business. You get it in there.
Well, we do. We have that. I understand that, but I'm saying
so that invalid by explicit wording limits it to the recipient.
So the thing is this. Those boilerplates are a SIG file. They're attached to your email automatically. It's not as though you send an email to somebody and think to yourself, let me attach this. So the argument, in fact, is made, and not just within this discussion, but in secular law, that those boilerplates, so to speak, are not worth the paper they're written on. They don't have any sway legally.
Now, you've got to ask everybody in this room, do you know, is your intention to have that boilerplate as fact? And I guarantee you there will be nobody that will say no. Everybody has that intention always. And it's a nurse boilerplate. But most firms put it in, or most people put it in, or even some...
I've had people who have sent me things, and when I've asked them, can I forward this, they say, sure, even though there's the boilerplate on it.
Okay, because they gave their permission.
No, but what I'm saying is they never intended the boilerplate to apply to that email. That boilerplate will also appear when you send out, you know, the latest joke you received from somebody to 500 people, just as much as it will appear when you send your proprietary information about your invention. You know, it's not discriminating between that which really is private and that which is not private. So don't be so quick to rely on the boilerplate is what I'm trying to say. Having said that, the argument against Rabbeinu Gershom being applied to email, hold on just 1 second. The argument against applying Rabbeinu Gershom to email is to say, fundamentally, we don't interpret decrees in a very broad way. We don't add it to law. We generally interpret things very narrowly. We don't make comparisons. That's a general rule with decrees, is that we're not supposed to expand them. Yes, Alex. Alex or Andrew?
Andrew.
Andrew. I was close. Okay, Andrew. My apologies.
My mother does the same thing. You asked that person a question.
Yeah. Why did I ask it before forwarding it? Because I go with the passage in the Talmud that we saw before, which says you have to assume you can't forward it until they tell you forward it. That's my working assumption. I also have bad habits that come from 12 years in the synagogue rabbinate, which, you know, you have to assume everything is confidential. You don't have the right to assume that you can divulge it. So that's, you know, that's my bias in general. Yes, all right.
Will that apply to these guys who forward? It's been forwarded. It's been forward a number of times. You find
like a chain.
Right. So in other words, if you get something that is clearly, so that may go into the category, well, two things. One, that may go into the category of the simcha or the funeral or whatever it is, as something that clearly is meant for public consumption. Number two, the people you forward it to may be very angry at you for forwarding it to them, so think carefully. Those sorts of things we don't necessarily want, so that's a separate issue. Now, I should note, we brought five different models, and I brought on your sheet, if you take a look at the heading up above number one, just I gave you a little, you know, one-line digest, so that way you can, you know, keep in mind the different issues. There's one other issue, of course, which is the Malchus, the law of the land. The law of the land says you are not permitted to intentionally intercept someone else's communications. It's Canada's criminal code, section 184.1. So that's just something to, you know about as a basic fact.
This is one more thing that you should know as well.
Yeah.
All the business media, accountants, lawyers, doctors, if anything ever goes wrong, the first thing the litigators say on the other side, we subpoena all agreements.
Right.
So that is such a dangerous thing that people don't really realize.
Right.
Emails are the most dangerous thing in the world. Before emails, litigators had a much tougher time proving things.
Right.
Today, it's a done deal because they just speak emails. So be very careful what you say.
That's a separate point, but true. In terms of the question that you asked in the beginning, the question of Jews and non-Jews, so it's very clear that the theft issue is going to apply with anybody, meaning I'm not allowed to steal from anybody. The question of the tort is less clear. Is this one of the prohibited torts where you can't do it to anybody at all, any human being? Or, because this really isn't an act of physical harm, maybe it's limited to family, and maybe that's Jewish-specific. The issue of invasion of privacy, I think, is Jews and non-Jews. I don't think it discriminates between. So we have enough to work with to say this will apply either way, even if it's not clear that every part of it will apply to everybody. Just because we're 35 minutes in, I want to start the applications to our questions. As always, I should state, my email address is at the top of the page, and I'm glad to continue conversations after as well. So don't be shy about emailing me to follow up, too. To go back to questions 1 and 2 that we had, either the coworker forgot to cut off the bottom of the exchange, or I think forgot to cut off the bottom of the exchange. Am I allowed to read it? Or someone misdirected an email. It was sent to me by mistake. So here we have parallels to this in other discussions in Jewish law, in the area of eavesdropping and in the area of postcards. Those are two areas where this comes up. In other words, somebody communicated with me, but they did it by accident, or they did it carelessly. They spoke, not eavesdropping where I go to the door and I put my ear up against it, but they're talking loudly. And now I am able to hear the conversation that they're having. It's the equivalent of the person who sent me information. So, or I'm in my cubicle at work and I can overhear the conversation that's going on next door. So the general rule is that we expect people to keep their voices down. In other words, it's not my fault for hearing something if they talk loudly. So take a look at source number 11. Rabbi Menachem Meiri is one of several who write on this. He's talking about the issue of overhearing somebody else's speech within his property. And he says, we're not concerned about harm from overhearing at all. We're not worried that you're hurting somebody when you overhear, meaning that the voice will enter from there to here directly because of the thinness of the barrier. For normal people are careful about their speech. He says, if a guy wants it quiet, he's going to keep it quiet. What he's talking about is the fact that there are certain rules about property owned by neighbors. If we have a yard that we own jointly, and I say, you know what, I want privacy in my section of the yard, help me build a wall. He's obligated to help me build a wall. However, I cannot force him to build a thick wall. Thin wall is fine, and I'm responsible to keep my voice down. That's
Are you also possible to tell him that his voice is loud? Meaning, if you hear his voice,
it depends.
Or do you have to turn and say, hey, excuse me, you're talking loudly. Do you really want me to hear this?
Right. So it really depends on what his volume level is. If the volume level is such that it's reasonable for him to think no one's listening, then you have to let him know. But if it's clear, he's shouting, then it's not your problem.
But that's email, because email, if you know, once you press send...
Well, that's the question, is going to be the analogy. I did want to show you, though, Canada's criminal code on this in source number 12, which talks about how you're not allowed to use an electromagnetic, acoustical, mechanical, or other device, any device or apparatus that is used or is capable of being used to interpret or to intercept a private communication. That's what you're not allowed to use. However, it doesn't include a hearing aid used to correct subnormal hearing of the user to not better than normal hearing. I'm allowed to walk around with a hearing aid that's going to give me normal hearing. I'm not allowed to walk around with it tuned up in order to intercept other people's communications. That's the criminal code. This, by the way, is important in the Torah because of two cases, at least that we know of, where very righteous people overhear others' conversations. Right, Sarah is in the tent and she hears what the guests say to Abraham about having a child. And the other one, what's the other one?
Rivka.
Right, Rebecca. Right, she's in the tent and she hears her husband tell her son, "Go out and get the game because I want to give you a blessing." And she, yeah, how by what right is she listening to the conversation? The answer is they're not trying to overhear. They're where they're allowed to be. They're licensed to be there. And he was talking loudly enough that they heard. So in eavesdropping, we said we do expect people to keep their voices down. What about postcards? So take a look at source number 13, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, who I quoted before. He says, one may not read his friend's letter without permission unless he throws it out. I am uncertain regarding the modern practice of sending open letters via the mail. May one read them, since the writers do not hide them? Are you allowed to read it? He's sending an open letter. And there, it's not by accident. He knows full well that anybody can read the postcard. Yes?
I'm just wondering about those two examples you gave. The case of Sarah, how did she benefit or alter anything by over here?
Oh, she didn't.
Of course. But in the case of Rick,
yep.
How does that relate to your email scenario? I mean,
right.
Clearly, whether she personally benefited,
right.
Maybe she did it to someone, because that's what she believed.
I mean, there are two separate questions, really. One question is she right to overhear? And the answer to that is she's fine. The second question is a separate question about the story of, but it doesn't. By what right did she interfere? So we can talk about that, but I'm not going to do it right now because I'm going to get back to this. But if there's time at the end, then we can come back to the storyline. But her understanding is that what she's doing is, in fact, the right thing to do for reasons that we can talk about. Fair? So... Based on the fact that when it comes to eavesdropping, we expect people to keep their voices down, and based on the fact that with a postcard, we do suggest that it's possible to say, you know what, you sent it in the open, it's your problem. Maybe if someone sends an email like that, and he didn't BCC, he included the information, it's not my problem. I now have access to the information because he gave it to me. However, if there are indications that this really was unintentional, then I'm not allowed to take advantage. It wasn't an intentional postcard. He sent it in an envelope, and the envelope tore open. And I can see that kind of a thing. Or he's talking loud. He's talking normally, but it's easy to overhear. That's a different story. So that we generally look for indications that it was meant to be private. So, for example, a person closes the door before having the conversation. That indicates he wants it to be private. That's from Rabbi Yisrael Pesach Feinhandler in the work Avnei Yoshva. If he takes mail that he received and he tries to shred it, but parts of it remained intact. So again, he demonstrated that he did not want it to be read. If you're dealing with somebody who, you know, or he sends out a recall notice on the email, so you know, that's very clear.
But if there isn't any recall notice?
So the question would really revolve around things that are more relevant for the particular case at hand. For example, if I see the timestamp on the email and he received it and then immediately turned around and sent it to me, then I understand he just missed it. He clearly, you know, didn't even think twice and just forwarded it and didn't notice what was at the bottom. If he's somebody who is normally very careful about this sort of thing, then again, I might ask myself, did this just get through by mistake? Because normally he wouldn't do it. But really, the best solution is to do what?
Right, I'd like to say,
yeah, ask him. Was this, you know, was everything below the line meant for me? That's the easiest way and the most honest way to deal with the problem. And to me, that would be the way to do it. And yeah, I think that's on the first two questions. What about the information that's already been leaked online? So then what? The emails are all out there. They're on people's websites to read. Now what? So there may be a leniency here. Take a look, please, at source number 14, a passage from the Talmud. Rabbi Bar Rav Huna said, anything said before three, meaning anything said in front of three people, does not involve harmful speech. That's not Lashon Hara. Why? Your friend has a friend, and the friend of your friend has a friend. In other words, everybody knows it. Now, there are multiple ways to explain this sentence. But the way Maimonides takes this sentence is in source number 15. He says, if this, meaning this statement, is said before three, the matter is already heard and known. And if one of the three retells it, there is no issue of harmful speech. This assumes he does not intend to communicate the matter and reveal it further. So in other words, I'm just reading what's posted online. It's public already. Everybody knows it. There's no Lashon Hara concern in doing so.
If you tell three people and you say, listen, I'm telling you this, and I'm watching you not say anything about it?
If he makes a statement of don't tell, then I think you have no license whatsoever. But the other piece of this that I think is very important to recognize is this only solves part of the problem. This may solve the Lashon Hara issue, right? It solves the problem of what we discussed before in terms of it being a tort. It's like an assault on him. It's not an assault. It may solve the problem of gossip and the idea of forcing him to communicate with people he didn't mean to. Because he knew he was communicating with the world once he said this to too many people. However, it won't necessarily solve all of the problems. The argument could still be that this is considered to be a violation of love your neighbor as yourself, which was invoked. I didn't mention it explicitly earlier, but it was one of the lines that was invoked regarding the way you treat others and the issue of it being a tort, like an assault on him. There are still reasons not to read it. I'm not so sure that the fact that you've solved the problem the fact that you have the option of saying it was said to three people, I don't think that solves all of the problems. I think there are still issues there, and certainly where you're reading it could harm that person in some way. I think that it may still be a problem. I'm not so comfortable with the idea of reading it, even if it is out there on a website. Although, I think that there are grounds for permitting. Yeah.
Again, coming back to the fact is that the presumption is once that person realizes and goes through and sees who he sent it to, he realizes that he sent it to you, even though you weren't the intended recipient, and that person may act on it or a certain way, even though I may not use it, because I'm not going to use it, but he's going to assume that I've read it,
yeah,
and then act on it. So the question is...
Do you notify him that you didn't? What are you saying?
Well, no, so what actually, I mean, the thing is, what are you actually supposed to do? Because even though you haven't read it, he would have assumed that you have read it. So therefore, he will take a negative inference and assume that you have read it.
Well, I think there you run into a separate question of what's better for this person. Is it better for him to know that I didn't read it, but that's also going to embarrass him, and will he trust me when I say I didn't read it? You know, versus just leave it be, and maybe he won't notice, and you didn't read it, and therefore all is good. And you have to know the other person well in order to make that kind of an assessment. It's very case by case. So maybe what we'll do next time is talk about the cases where you are justified in reading it, and the problems of suspecting your business partner, government issues like the case of the San Bernardino iPhone, questions between spouses, or the nanny cam for the babysitter. Maybe what we'll do next time is talk about that as a part two. Jeffrey.
Yeah, at least half the stuff that goes viral is because we're preying on someone's misfortune. There's something that's not appropriate content. It's lewd, it's suggestive, it's whatever. I would hope that there's some ethical reason why, even though it's in the public domain, you should not be telling people, sure, go ahead, everybody can see this online.
Correct. Well, where there's something wrong with the substance of it, where I shouldn't be looking at it even if it is intended for me, that's up in the, yes, then I certainly shouldn't be spreading it to others and so on. Where it involves taking advantage of somebody or Lashon Hara, then yes, I should not be spreading it. I mean, that fits into these various prohibitions.
So if Lashon Hara is said in front of three people, it doesn't mean, well, it's in the public domain and everybody can go.
So, well, what we're saying is what you just did is actually a very important point, which I was hinting at before. I told you that the line about being said in front of three people could be interpreted in multiple ways. I gave you Rambam's way to interpret that line. But there are others who read it differently. In other words, he said, if this is said in front of three, meaning that the statement was told already to three people, others read this line as, it's where the original person communicated it to three. That's where you have this license, or the event took place in front of three people, so there were three witnesses anyway, and there was no privacy. Like, there are a lot of different ways to read that line, and that will influence how we look at what you're saying. This is a much more complicated line than that. That's one of the reasons I'm uncomfortable using it as the basis for allowing people to read the leaked emails that are available. I don't think it's so clear cut. Okay, then to be continued, God willing, next time. If anyone did not sign in, please make sure that you do so. Once again, Jonathan Schwartzowitzki Feldman, thank you so much for hosting and providing lunch.